Well, tonight we come to the trial at Vanity Fair, and I will do my best to end on time. I apologize for keeping you late. I know that I need to get you out of here on time. I just want you to know I'm sensitive to that. We come to the time when Christian and faithful have been arrested and embarrassed and humiliated and put in stock and in prison, and so the time of their trial is before them. And I want to begin by reading Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 4. I am charging and requiring my 7th grade Bible class at New Covenant to memorize Hebrews 11 throughout the year. And it is, of course, not only a wonderful exercise of seeing people act in faith, seeing people endure in faith, seeing people endure sometimes to death by in faith. But then I love the way that it ends, because it ends in a way that charges us to follow in like fashion. He says, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin." As we open the next text in Pilgrim's Progress, we find they come to a convenient time being appointed, that they brought them forth to their trial in order to their condemnation. You might wonder why in the world they have a trial for such a thing as this. It's important, I think, as we go on to realize that they have not been arraigned in any way, have they? They have not been charged. They just simply have been found guilty first. And this is such a good exercise because we need to see beyond the injustice of it. If anything, John Bunyan is telling us and encouraging us as Christians, the injustice of the moment is not the issue. We should expect injustice. The injustice, or is if it's not the issue, it's what we should do in the face of injustice. And that is not always the clear thing, not always the evident thing, but it is always the call for us to be in prayer. And of course, as we go through this trial, you're going to find that there are areas which remind you of other things. You think of another unjust trial in the Bible. Jesus Christ, the facing a trial without charges. What? Job, well, put to trial, yes. Daniel? You mean by being thrown into the lion's den, being framed?
Yeah, Joseph was thrown in prison.
Joseph, yeah. Yeah, there was no trial there. Oh, boy, you guys are coming up with some good ones. See, my mind didn't go any farther than Stephen in Acts. That's right. Yeah, right. Of course. Yes, Naboth. Hadn't thought of that. Exactly. I was thinking that all along. No, very good examples. You get all kinds of illustrations, don't you, in the scriptures regarding believers facing injustice and the model that they are, the character that they display, and the instructions that we are to learn about how to face those things ourselves. It is a perfect world, isn't it, when we face trials and we can cry out injustice and somebody will actually listen and change things? Oh, yes, of course, it's unjust. Let me fix that. Lawyers thrive on the fact that that people in the world come to not only expect but demand that justice. And they pretend to be able to promise it for a fee. And not they don't even then, they aren't able to come through with a justice that is ever thoroughly satisfying. The call and the charge as Christians is to realize that this is a sin-cursed and fallen world, and that injustice is the name of the game by definition. That's what curse upon creation means. It means injustice. We won't always have satisfaction. We won't always sing Rolling Stones songs. It's the call. It's the comfort and the assurance that Christ is there, and that He is in charge. And more than that, He is. That's of course how we comfort ourselves at those times. Christ is in charge. I know that, you know, probably, but we also need to remind ourselves that God is the one leading us through these things. Psalm 23 tells us that God leads us through the valley of the shadow of death. They don't just come along by accident or, you know, because it happens. God providentially ordains and presents these things before us. And we've even seen in the language of the evangelist that these are things that you must do. You must proceed through Vanity Fair. You must proceed. This is the road to life. This is the way to life lies through this. You must go through. Changes in our lives like that are not always welcome, and they sometimes result in great outcry from us. But when it's all said and done, we are often called simply to endure and to realize that the Lord who has put this in front of us is also the Lord that will see us through. Then a convenient time being appointed, they brought them forth to their trial in order to their condemnation. So in other words, the trial's already been judged, you know. When the time was come, they were brought before their enemies and arraigned. The judge's name was Lord Hategood. A little blatant, isn't it? You don't have to wonder what side he's on. It's always, you know, here we have a situation where, in fact, through this whole episode, you're going to find that John Bunyan has just a ball with names. They start coming out of the woodwork in here, and we usually spend a lot of time analyzing names. We won't have time to even do that this time. But this is fairly easy to understand. You know, like wearing a badge. His name is Lord Hategood. Now, what does that tell you, first of all? There's a surface definition of that, but what does it mean to you that the judge's name is Lord Hategood? What is what? All right, what is he biased toward? All right, he's biased toward evil, and he's, of course, he hates good. That's the whole point. And you know, one of the things that we do say about justice is that it must be unbiased. The judge must be able to set his own inklings, his own persuasions aside, and judge fairly, you know, that's equitably, that kind of setting. But at the same time we're saying that, we still have a basis for law, or a principle of law, that we trust a judge to make a determination of. That principle is something that everybody agrees to. Everybody accepts, everybody understands this is right, this is good. And the base, you know, so what is the basis for law here? You know, it's easy for us to say, yeah, he hates good. Okay, that's okay. But what is the basis? What is his basis for law? If he hates good, what is his basis for law? Is that an odd question?
Probably a self-serving politician type.
Could be.
I'm thinking of the historical context of Bunyan's time and how a lot of judges and officials would learn to sort of figure out who's in charge. And
so purely political, yeah. So. Right, this suggestion here is that Judge Hategood is patterned after somebody that perhaps even John Bunyan was standing before at one time in his life. But there's a definite defiance of God in this. There's a definite uplifting of man. There's a definite uplifting. There's a definite upholding of some principle. Even a judge called Hategood is still going to have some principle by which he will determine right from wrong. That's what I'm getting at. It's not left totally arbitrary, but there is still some basis, some foundational principle. And of course, in this case, hating good is that principle. Because good requires a definition, doesn't it? In order to be good, we have to know what good is. And in order to hate that, we have to know what it is that we might despise it. We might decide it's definitely not good. So, as the prophets say, the people would call evil good and good evil. So here's a judge who decides on cases before him based on a rejection of that which is good according to what we would say the Christian worldview, that God has made all things, that there is the basic order to life, that God's principles stand over everything, that there is a moral order to all of creation. All of that is rejected. In other words, he's embracing a very humanist point of view, man-centered. I even define what is good. I define and determine what is proper and what is appropriate. So it's more than just simply a bias, just simply that he doesn't like Christians, but it's, of course, the fundamental principle about why it is he doesn't like Christians, why it is he would reject the church, why it is he doesn't want anything to do with Christianity. Is that starting to bring it up to speed? Does it sound a little more modern now? You know, isn't that the kind of thing that's being advocated in the world today? You know, we have does it floor you? Does it boggle your mind that you know Supreme Court justices are, you know, the whole debate over that today is over issues that are found in the Bible. Not that you know somebody is in lockstep with a religious point of view. But it's, well, if you have any association with this, that means by definition you're out. You are not good. That is to be removed. That's to be set aside. Not just because it's a religion, but because man is the measure of all things. That is the good. That is the determination. That is what we're going to measure everything by. So the judge's name was Lord Hategood. Their indictment was one and the same in substance, though somewhat varying in form, and the contents of it is this. So this is what they are accused of, that they were enemies to and disturbers of their trade, that they made their commotions and divisions in town, and had won a party to their own most dangerous opinions in contempt of the law of their prince. Now think about what that means and tell me in your own words what the charges are. They were enemies to and disturbers of their trade being the trade of the town. They had made commotions and divisions in the town. Okay, so they broke, they were, you know, against the disturbing the peace, and had won a party to their own most dangerous opinions in contempt of the law of their prince. Daniel? Insurrectionists. Oh, nah, that's too easy. Too easy.
They're not tolerant.
No, okay, they're not... they're not tolerant. Okay, that sounds modern. They're proselytizing, okay, which, of course, as far as being Christian, that's a problem. If they were of any of the other religions in town, that would be okay, right? You know, I mean, again, we're really drawing some parallels here. Just bottom line, that they're just not being politically correct. They're just not fitting in. They are causing disturbances because they are different. And you know, in a place, in a town that thrives on difference, they're too different. They don't fit. And then Faithful began to answer. So here's Faithful's testimony. And this, of course, is what reminds me so much of Stephen. Now, this is Faithful's time on the block. He's on the dock, rather. This is his opportunity to defend himself, to excuse or explain himself here. And so listen to the words he says. Then Faithful began to answer that he had only set himself against that which had set itself against him, that is higher than the highest. And said he, as for disturbance, I make none, being myself a man of peace. The parties that were won to us were won by beholding our truth and innocence, and they only turned from the worse to the better. And as to the king you talk of, since he is Beelzebub, the enemy of our Lord, I defy him and his angels. So what do you think of his defense? What did he and Stephen have in common in what they said?
Well, he's confirming the charges.
How so?
In fact, we did gain a following here because he says that it's to him that is higher than the highest, so it's to Christ.
Right. That's...
So, I guess that's what I'm confirming the charges.
Okay, so he confirmed the charges. What else did he do? Right. It was definitely against Beelzebub. What else? What's the most important thing that I think that he really does hold up here? What he spoke is the truth. Chris? Evil, yes. He was pretty straight with them. Did he cry out, "This is a sham"? This is unjust. I need a lawyer. Things that he could have and appropriately have done, but didn't do. He also did not point attention to himself. In fact, his defense was the defense of Christ. That's the point. He takes the opportunity of his own arrest and his own trial to defend Christ. Isn't that what Stephen did? He stands up at the dock and he doesn't say, "Look, what is this? Is this nuts or what? I've been accused for nothing. I'm a Jew like you guys are. I haven't done anything. Let me alone." He takes the opportunity and he pours gas on the fire for himself personally. And he takes it and he defends the name of Christ. And that's what Faithful does. He takes his own opportunity for his own defense, and he defends Christ. He preaches Christ. Then the proclamation was made that they that had ought to say for their lord the king against the prisoner at the bar should forthwith appear and give in their evidence. And so there came in three witnesses, to wit, envy, superstition, and pickthank. They were then asked if they knew the prisoner at the bar and what they had to say for their lord the king against him. So we bring in three witnesses, and the first one is called envy. What does envy mean? We know we're not supposed to envy. It says in the commandments, don't envy, but what does envy mean? What?
Desire someone else's or some other.
Something, 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 something.
You don't have wanting what somebody else has.
Wanting something that someone else has. Envy is going to bear witness against faithful. Isn't that interesting? Now, wait a minute. I thought, you know, these guys hated him. And now, but the first witness up is somebody that says, so what would you think envy would have to say? What is envy's motive for speaking against faithful? Well, maybe, maybe. But isn't it interesting? I just, you wouldn't have expected this. Envy goes through Middle English and Old French to the Latin. It means painful or resentful awareness of an advantage enjoyed by another, joined with a desire to possess the same advantage. That's a long definition. But it means not just wanting something someone else has, wanting to be as good or better than someone else. That's envy. Wanting to be as good or better than someone else. Envy is going to speak against faithful. Okay, so he gets up there, and this is what he says. He says, then stood forth envy and said to this effect, my lord, I have known this man a long time. How could he have known him a long time? Is he just flat out lying? I don't think so. You don't envy somebody immediately. Usually it builds. So if he's known somebody a long time, where are we really? We're still in the city of destruction, aren't we? You know, in all sense of the word, these are neighbors to Christian as he has made his pilgrimage. He hasn't literally left his home. He's still dwelling among the people in the world that know him and have watched this change in him. They don't understand it. They see the benefits of conversion and of growth and of wisdom, and they envy it, although they don't want any of this spiritual hocus-pocus stuff. He's seen him, he's watched him for some time, and he will attest upon my oath before this honorable bench that he is, hold, give an oath, got to swear him in. Envy is going to be sworn in. Then he said, my lord, this man, notwithstanding his plausible name, is one of the vilest men in our country. So he begins by rebuking and destroying him in terms of his standing. He's criticizing him. Envy does that, doesn't it? Isn't envy a strange sin? You want something inside. The way it expresses itself is to destroy that something in someone else. You understand that? It's not, hey, how'd you do that? Or give me that recipe. It's, she makes wonderful chocolate cake. You know, I'm thinking that inside. But outside, I'm going to say to everybody else, it's filled with rat poison. So that no one will like her chocolate cake. That's envy. And that's what he's doing. He said, my lord, notwithstanding this plausible name is one of the vilest men in our country. He neither regards prince nor people, law nor custom, but doth all that he can to possess all men with certain of his disloyal notions, which he in general calls principles of faith and holiness. He's got it memorized. And in particular, I heard him once affirm, that Christianity and the customs of our town of vanity were diametrically opposite and could not be reconciled. He is even a good student. He not only understands this, he can repeat it back. He can tell you, he can give Faithful's argument. He knows it backwards and forwards. He has studied this. And he's accurate. He's telling exactly the truth. By which saying, my Lord, he doth at once not only condemn all laudable doings, but us in the doing of them. So envy speaks up, and he describes very accurately Faithful's witness. By the way, the quote he has there, that Christianity and the customs of our town, Vanity, were diametrically opposite and could not be reconciled. Do you believe that? Do you believe that about yourself and about the world? Do you really believe that? That they're diametrically opposed? They cannot be reconciled? Is there no compromise that you can have in the world as a Christian? Are you willing to take that stand so well that somebody else recognizes it in you and can describe it of you? Or does everybody in the world who know you say, oh, yeah, he's a good egg. You know, he's a little quirky. Goes to church. But boy, he's rowdy enough on Wednesday night or Thursday night. It's all that matters to me, you know. Do they see that diametrical? Do they see you stand for Christian principles? Do they understand enough to be able to repeat it back? He says he condemns our doings and us. Again, the testimony of Christ in Faithful is very clear. So the judge says to him, hast thou any more to say? And Envy says, my Lord, I could say much more. Only I would not be tedious to the court. Yeah, he's a very sensitive, very humble man. Yet if need be, when the other gentlemen have given in their evidence, I'll be glad to pour more salt on the wound. Rather than anything be wanting that will dispatch him, I will enlarge my testimony against him. And so he was bid stand by. Next witness against him is superstition. Superstition is a word that comes through the Middle English and French to the Latin, meaning a belief or practice resulting from ignorance, a fear of the unknown, trust in magic or chance, which has good reputation in our day. So trusting in magic or chance is not necessarily derogatory, or a false conception of causation. Of course, it would take a understanding of false. Superstition comes up, bid him look upon the prisoner, and then also asked what he could say for their lord, the king, against him. Superstition. What do you think superstition's going to say? What, if you were superstition, what would you have against Faithful? Okay, so what's your accusation of him? Knowing that difference, what's going to be superstition's issue? If it's belief in by ignorance, in other words, what does that mean? It means that your belief system is groundless, first of all. There isn't any ground, there's nothing, chance is a good illustration of that. You know, there's nothing there to stand on. And if there's nothing there to stand on, then, of course, you're really, superstition functions on enormous subjectivism and personal influence, personal feeling, personal emotion. When somebody goes through without a grounding understanding of things, when a person goes through an emotional experience and you have reason, for whatever reason, you have reason to call into question what they have experienced. It's not out of the question that they might react emotionally. You know, you're saying what I experienced wasn't real? Well, maybe not that much, but are you sure you saw that ghost? Are you sure that that it jumped out at you and said, boo? Of course I'm sure. I experienced it. Who are you to tell me? I didn't. So superstition is going to be kind of based on that emotionalism that is hard to confront. Dan? Okay, profiting off of other people's superstition.
Right.
I write the local horoscope for the paper.
Right. We no longer need you anymore.
Yeah. Okay, good. Good point. Very good point. My Lord, I have no great acquaintance with this man, nor do I desire to have further knowledge of him. However, this I know for sure, that he is a very pestilent fellow. From some discourse that the other day I had with him in this town, for when talking with him, I heard him say that our religion was not, and such by which a man could by no means please God. Which saying of his, my lord, your lordship very well knows, was necessarily thence will follow to it, that we still do worship in vain, and yet we are still in our sins, and finally we shall be damned. And this is that which I have to say. So what is his, he's quoted him again, that he's listened. What is his issue? What? He has the gall to tell me I'm wrong. Right? What do you mean I can't trust my emotions or my feelings or whatever I want to believe to be true? Who are you to tell me I'm wrong? Subjectivism is a religion of opinion, right? Remember? It's a religion of whatever I feel I want to believe is going to be true. True is just a balloon full of helium floating in the air. And so he's accusing him of objective measurement. He's saying that I have been measured against his ruler and I have been found wanting. And then was pick thank sworn. Now there's a word we don't really kick around very much anymore. Pick thank just sounds snarly, doesn't it? Pick thank. I actually found in the dictionary the term pick a thank. Oh, that helps. Meaning to seek one's favor. An archaic form of sycophant. Does anybody know what sycophant means? Ah, very good! Spoken like a true sycophant, right? Grove City grad jumps right up. I know what sycophant means. Was I pronouncing it right, by the way? Is it sycophant? Sick and tired of fant. Okay, sycophant. Sycophant comes from the Latin meaning servile, self-seeking flatterer. Okay, so we have the servile, self-sneaking flatterer sworn in. You tell the truth? Oh, sure. And bid say what he knew in behalf of their lord the king against the prisoner of the bar. My lord and you gentlemen all, this fellow I have known of a long time, him we won't believe, and have heard him speak things that ought not to be spoke, for he hath railed on our noble Prince Beelzebub, and hath spoke contemptibly of his honorable friends, whose name are, and we'll just go through these real quickly, Lord Old Man, the Lord Carnal Delight, the Lord Luxurious, the Lord Desire of Vain Glory, my old lord, Lechery, Sir Having Greedy, with all the rest of our nobility, that's nobility. These are the dignitaries of the town, and he has shown contempt for those things. And this is the witness, remember, this is the witness of the one who wants to flatter to his own benefit. And he hath said, moreover, that if all men were of his mind, if possible, there is not one of these noblemen should have any longer a being in this town. Besides, he has not been afraid to rail on you, my lord, who are now appointed to be his judge, calling you an ungodly villain, with many other such like vilifying terms with which he hath bespattered most of the gentry of our town. The description of all of the friends of Prince Beelzebub do not take us by surprise. The question, of course, again, is these are people that are looked up to and recognized and held noble in the world. And the challenge that's before us is, you know, the trial of faithful is to be seen in, you know, as our trial too. There's meant to be an identity with faithful here. And so, you know, if faithful is held against his standing apart from these kinds of things that are held up in such nobility, would that be true of us as well? Are we diametrically opposed to these things? Would we stand, or would we flatter just such guys to get what we want in the world, like everybody else does? How do these guys get to such positions? Well, because Pig thanks Brown Nose and lift them up and bribe them and encourage them. And you have them in your world, and we are to be opposed to them, not to gain by them, but to be actually opposed to them. And with this Pickthank had told his tale, the judge directed his speech to the prisoner of the bar, saying, "Thou renegade, heretic, and traitor, hast thou heard what these honest gentlemen have witnessed against thee?" This is the judge talking. You know, the judge, I guess he heard that he had said some remarks against him too. And he has, of course, long since judged this. And now, because he hates good, hates the integrity even of his position, he has already judged and condemned before turning the case over to the jury. Faithful responds the faithful responds, "May I speak a few words in my own defense?" And the judge says, "Sirrah, sirrah." What does that mean? This is a cute little term that you might be interested in. Sirrah. No, it doesn't mean quiet. It's actually a derogatory term. It's like the alter ego of sir. It's you jerk. You are sir being a polite term of address to a man. Sirrah is a derogatory address to a man. It's the opposite. And he says, "Sirrah, sirrah, thou deservest to live no longer, but to be slain immediately upon the place. Yet that all men may see our gentleness towards thee, let us see what thou hast to say." And John Bunyan interjects with a poem at this point, saying, "Now, faithful, play the man, speak for thy God. Fear not the wicked's malice, nor their rod. Speak boldly, man, the truth is on thy side. Die for it, and to life in triumph ride." His life is on the line. He knows it. It's not really even a question. But the pressure is on nonetheless. What will faithful say? What will he do? Will he now rail against the injustice of the court? Will he now call for equity? Faithful addresses the court and says, number one, "I say then, in answer to what Mr. Envy has spoken." So he's going to address the specific witnesses in their remarks. As I say, in answer to what Mr. Envy has spoken, remember, let's just remember what Envy said. What did Envy say? What? Okay, Envy watched him for a long time, and you remember Envy really desires even what he's got, but hates him because he has it and wants to destroy him. And so he was able to repeat, he's studied, and he's heard Faithful say those things. He knows exactly what he said, and so he says in response to that, he says, I say in answer to what Mr. Envy has spoken, I never said aught but this, that what rules or laws or custom or people were flat against the word of God are diametrically opposite to Christianity. If I have said amiss in this, convince me of my error, and I am ready here before you to make my recantation. So what does he say about Envy's testimony? He's right, Judge. That's exactly what I said. What's the lesson there, by the way? If Envies are watching and studying you, even in hatred, be careful what you say. Not to protect yourself, but to make sure that Envy gets it right. Make sure that you speak clearly of your testimony. To make sure that even your enemies know for sure, are clear about what they despise in you. Yeah, Dan. Oh, yeah.
Those, yes, we oppose, but not an insurrectionist.
Right. It, yeah.
Which is really the history of a lot of Christianity in a lot of the world.
The accusation, anyway. Yeah.
They say, no, we're not insurrectionists, but where does that
stand? You think of Jesus before Pilate, you know, being accused of being against Caesar and saying, that's not the problem, that's not the issue. My kingdom is not of this world. Number two, as to the second, to wit, Mr. Superstition, what did superstition say against Christian? I mean, against faithful? Superstition was, let's see, ignorance. He insulted my faith in nothing. Remember? That's what it was. He insulted my faith in nothing. As to the second, Mr. Superstition, and his charge against me, I said only this, that in the worship of God, there is required a divine faith. But there can be no divine faith without a divine revelation, of the will of God. Therefore, whatever is thrust into the worship of God, this is not agreeable, that is not agreeable to divine revelation, cannot be done but by an human faith, which faith will not profit to eternal life. Why did he answer him so in such long terms? What is his point there? Can we read it again? Carol?
Pastor, I just forget that this guy was writing for, he was in prison Christian for his belief. But to me, everything he's writing is really about the church that put him there. There are superstitious ways. They were so...
Oh, okay, good.
I know all this is personal, and that's what's so amusing when I read the book, that I can say, oh boy, is this alive today?
Good point.
Took all that against.
What is he against? Do you remember, historically speaking, what is he against? Was he a conformist or a nonconformist? He was a nonconformist because he was being ordered by the Church of England to conform to what? Do you remember? Their form of worship, their form of hierarchy, and for the Puritans, it was the Book of Common Prayer. which they saw as a man-made document with full of man-made artificial stuff that was lacking in the spirit, and they refused to use it. And yet the state church was saying, you must use it, or we'll throw you in prison. Throw me in prison, John Bunyan says. And so he did. So here comes superstition. Good, I think you've made a very good point. Here comes superstition. What is superstition's religion based on? Nothing. Right? And he's saying this, I think Carol's on to something. He's saying this about that. And they are saying, superstition is saying, well, you've insulted my religion. And what does faithful respond to here? Now think about that. Let me read it to you again. How does faithful respond? That in the worship of God, there is required a divine faith, but there can be no divine faith without a divine revelation of the will of God. Revelation of the will of God is what? Scripture. And that's that reinforced by and led by the Spirit of God. That would have been very important. Therefore, whatever is thrust into the worship of God that is not agreeable to divine revelation cannot be done but by a human faith, which is faith not to profit. Now, we call that today the regulative principle. And the regulative principle, as it's stated in the confession, goes this way. The acceptable way of worshiping the true God is instituted by himself, and so limited by his own revealed will that he may not be worshipped according to the imaginations and devices of men or the suggestions of Satan under any visible representation or any other way not prescribed in the Holy Scripture. The idea is that what God does not tell us he wants in worship should not be allowed in worship. And that's the pattern that historically Puritanism has been built on. It's the pattern that we've received and that we hold to and believe the Bible to teach. And it is exactly what he's rebuking superstition for doing, saying you are bringing in the devices and the inventions of men and of Satan, and you're calling this the worship of God, and that's improper. Did you have your hand up? Oh, yeah, yeah. To add to the worship or the living of God, the trappings that they had, all those that were involved with that.